طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Ilan Pappe, the Israeli New Historian, has edited a new book titled Israel and South Africa, The Many Faces of Apartheid. Today's presentation on This Week in Palestine features Ilan Pappe and the author of one of the chapters in the book, British journalist Jonathan Cook, now living in Nazareth, discussing the nuances of apartheid. Increasingly, Israel is being referred to as an apartheid state, a state that has created a discriminatory society by law, a state that defines rights, benefits, and advantages for its Jewish population that are not available to others of its citizens or residents, a, quote, legal separatist state. Some 50 Israeli laws define this separatism. It is often compared to apartheid South Africa, and in this book, the similarities and differences between the two apartheid regimes are compared and analyzed. The United Nations Apartheid Convention declares that apartheid is a crime against humanity, and that inhumane acts resulting from its policies and practices of apartheid and similar policies and practices of racial segregation and discrimination are international crimes. Here we explore modern apartheid in Israel, condoned, indeed supported by the United States, despite our attempts to bury our own Jim Crow legacy. Our presentation begins with an introduction of the issue and the participants by one of Ilan Pappe's doctoral students, Yara Awahi.
Thank you all very much for coming to this book launch of Israel and South Africa, The Many Faces of Apartheid. When the bookshop asked me to do this introduction, I was a bit apprehensive. Ilan Pappe, who's the editor of this book, is, as Mahmoud said, he's the supervisor of my PhD, and I owe him a lot of work. So I hope he's not going to bring me up on that later. Anyway, as I said, Ilan Pappe is actually the editor of the book, and he's currently the professor at University of Exeter. He's also the director of the European Centre for Palestine Studies. Ilan is regarded as one of the Israeli New Historians, a group of Israeli academics who sought to challenge the Zionist narrative in the late 80s and 90s, particularly surrounding the events of 1948. In 2006, he published his seminal work, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. And since then, he's written many books on Israel and Palestine, all of which, of course, are available at the bookshop. In much of his work, Ilan has written extensively about settler colonialism, a framework which he and many other scholars believe more accurately represents the situation on the ground here. What often follows settler colonialism is a system of apartheid, which keeps the native, the inferior other, separate from that of the superior settler race. These concepts form the theoretical framework for the book. And tonight we're also lucky to be joined by Jonathan Cook, one of the contributors of the book. Jonathan is an award-winning British journalist and a writer based in Nazareth. He's written three books on Israel and Palestine, which are also available at the bookshop, and many more chapters and articles. In the book we're presenting tonight, Jonathan's chapter is entitled Visible Equality as a Confidence Trick, and he focuses on the Palestinian citizens of Israel. In this chapter, Jonathan manages to encapsulate the situation of these often forgotten Palestinians and concludes that separateness, or apartheid, and inequality based on ethnic belonging has been codified in Israeli law and as such has been shielded from international condemnation. As you may have guessed by now, The book itself does not ask whether apartheid exists in Israel and Palestine. Rather, it affirms seriously and intelligently that it does indeed exist, and offers a series of arguments using a comparative approach on Israel and South Africa. The chapters in the book show us not only how Israel and apartheid South Africa are similar, but also, importantly, how they are different. As a result, what we see is an excellent book and a brave publication that allows us to take the discussion to the next level. So I'd like to end this introduction with just a quote from Virginia Tilley's chapter, Redefining Conflict in Israel and Palestine, which I think might be interesting to many of you who work within an international law framework. Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip has digressed so far from the terms of reference of international humanitarian law that Israel's behavior cannot be adequately described in terms of discrete violations. Israel now controls the OPT in all ways consistent with sovereignty, except the political will of the territory's population. Steadily settling the West Bank, Israel's behavior is fully consistent with settler colonialism. With 500,000 settlers in the West Bank, the situation could have been recognized as having passed the tipping point long ago, were it not the international community still wedded doggedly to the paradigm of belligerent occupation and evolving formulations of Palestinian people that have, under enormous pressure, adjusted to suit the Zionist project. The precedent of apartheid South Africa helps to clarify that Israel's willingness to consign portions of the West Bank to a Palestinian state is most accurately comparable to a Bantustan strategy to concentrate black people within politically suffocating, disarticulated, and economically crippling enclaves. One irony emerges most clearly from the South African comparison, that the UN has actually obstructed resolution of the conflict by insisting on Israel's withdrawal from the OPT. It is incontestable that legally Israel holds the territories under belligerent occupation and has illegally transferred Jewish settlers into East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Yet in insisting that Israel not be allowed to annex these territories, the UN has unintentionally forestalled the normal solution to the conflict in advanced cases of settler colonialism, granting full citizenship and equal rights to the indigenous people. Such is the situation in Israel and Palestine, where the colonial state has rendered obsolete one course of justice for the Palestinian people, statehood, while the international community, acting dutifully to preserve international order and norms, has helped to forestall the only logical alternative, unification. So I won't talk anymore. The book is available over there, and I really recommend that you read it, buy it, share it if you don't want to each buy a copy, but really it's really a great publication. I'd like to pass over to Professor Ilan Pappe, and then we'll move on to Jonathan Cook.
Thank you. I want to begin by thanking the Educational Bookshop and the Institute for hosting us. It's great to see so many people coming tonight to share with us our understandings and our constant attempt to understand the reality, and even more importantly, how to change this reality. In many ways, the book is yet another stage in this search for a better understanding of the way forward. For about 40 or 50 years, in many places like this, institutes, universities, academic centers, the media, and so on, there was one dominant way or paradigm through which the conflict in Palestine had been analyzed. And this was the paradigm or model of a conflict between two national movements. There is one country for which two national movements are fighting for. They have equal right to the land. They have an equal attachment to the land. And hence, what you need is to find a reasonable mediator who could find a compromise that would answer the aspirations of both national movements, given the fact that they both have a justified claim to the land. This is still the main paradigm for peace that the quartet is using, that the mainstream media and academia and politicians are using. And it's not surprising that the main outcome of this paradigm is the two-state solution as the only possible way forward, because if both national movements have equal right to the land, partitioning the land between the two national movements seems to make sense from a kind of political point of view, strategic point of view, and so on. Of course, once you go to higher resolutions, so to speak, and you see that one side is offered 80% of that land and the other side at best is offered 20% of that land, you begin to be a bit doubtful about the ideas of a two-state solution. But let's leave it alone for a moment. The basic concept of a conflict between national movements had not been challenged properly, apart from marginal groups, either in academia or in the media or in politics. Now, in the last 10 or 15 years, from within the civil society around the world, the civil society in Palestine, from within the academia and on the margins of the political systems around the world, came a different paradigm. A paradigm that said, no, we're sorry, the conflict here is not between two national movements. The conflict here was and is between a movement of settlers and the native people. That doesn't mean yet that we know how to solve it, but at least we are speaking a language that relates to the reality on the ground. And the fact that this is a situation where you have settlers who came in the late 19th century, who are now in their third generation, definitely, settlers who succeeded in creating their own society, their own state, their own culture, who are still colonizing the native people, are still settling on the land of the native people, is a much better framework to explain to people what goes on here, why there is still violence, why all the peace effort until today has failed, and why we have wasted years and years on using a false paradigm that produced a lot of Nobel Peace Prizes and mountains of documents and hundreds of academic careers and even political careers, but nothing on the ground itself. And this is where we need to go to that paradigm, settler colonialism and its connection to the idea of apartheid. Because it was not only the people who supported the perception of the conflict as a conflict between two national movements that got it wrong, for good reasons and bad reasons. I mean, not everybody should be criticized for having this optimistic view that all you need is a grown-up that would come and help these children to find a solution. Surprisingly, they thought that the grown-up is the United States of America, which is a bit ridiculous, especially if we can see the new personification of a grown-up American candidate for presidency, someone who hasn't crossed the age of five. Nonetheless, one can understand why people felt optimistic and reasonably satisfied with this approach. But it's not the only problem. This was not the only obstacle for trying to expose the reality in history and at present as a reality of settler colonialism. Also, the Palestinian National Movement, for understandable reasons, I don't know if you are aware of it, refused to see Zionism as settler colonialism. There's a difference between settler colonialism and colonialism. When we talk about colonialism, we talk about people who are sent by an empire to colonize some place outside of Europe. And when the empire falls, disintegrates, the people are going back to their metropole homeland, as happened to the British in India, the French in Algeria, and so on. Settler colonialists are people who were not sent by an empire. They ran away, they fled, for various reasons, a different reason. These are people who fled from Europe for and looked for a safe haven. They looked for a safe home. The problem is that most of them also looked for a homeland, not just a home. And when they wanted the homeland, they found out that usually the places that they arrived or coveted or wanted for all kinds of reasons, these places were already inhabited by another people. The famous, and unfortunately we just lost him this year, scholar of settler colonialism, Patrick Wolfe, says that at this moment in history where the people who fled meet the native people, emerges something that he calls the logic of elimination. The logic of elimination means that if I want to turn a new place to my homeland, I have to get rid of the native people. In the United States of America, this ended in genocide. It ended in a similar way in Latin America, in Australia, in New Zealand. In two places, the logic of elimination took a different form. In Palestine and in South Africa. In both places, eliminating the native was not done through genocide, but through either other crimes against humanity, such as ethnic cleansing, dispossession, apartheid, all kinds of means that meant to rob the native from his or her homeland and reattach the settler to that homeland, by appropriating the native's history, the native's attachment to the land. It's not surprising that this is also true about other settler colonialist projects, not just South Africa and Israel. When you appropriate the history of the people you destroyed, you quite conveniently even appropriate their own names of places, their own habits, their own customs. In America, it's really bizarre. I mean, they're using the names of Native American tribes that have been exterminated for naming their weapons of mass destruction. Tomahawk, Apache, and so on. The Israelis have not gone there yet. God knows what will come from their invention. But this appropriation of the history of the place itself means that you also assume that the place that was that belonged to the native is yours. Its history, its climate, its heritage. Settler colonialism in Palestine started in the late 19th century. And its first serious implementation of the logic of elimination. And as I said, the logic of elimination in other places was genocide. The logic of elimination in Palestine was implemented in the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948. This was not a coincidence of war. This was not the result of a war. This was the conclusion of a systematic planning by the settler colonialist movement of Zionism that wanted to get rid of the native Palestinian population. The reason that they did not succeed of expelling all the Palestinians, the reason that they did not succeed in occupying the whole of Palestine had to do with circumstances, capacities, possibilities, and Palestinian resistance. It had nothing to do with any self-imposed limitation of the vision that can be simply defined as wishing to have as much of Palestine as possible with as few Palestinians as possible. It is an interesting historical coincidence that in the year that the settler colonialist movement in Palestine decided to try and get rid of the Palestinians is the year when the settler movement or settler community of the whites in South Africa decided to institutionalize the apartheid system. It happened at the same year that both settler colonialist movement wanted to institutionalize through a state apparatus, the logic of elimination that elsewhere was implemented through genocide. In these two case studies, they found alternative means, and they were using these alternative means in South Africa until the fall of apartheid there. They're still using these means today all over Palestine, not just in the West Bank, not just in the Gaza Strip, also in the Galilee and also in the Nakab, and Jonathan will talk about it more in his talk. So I began by saying that also the Palestinian national movement did not look at Zionism as settler colonialism, but as a colonialist movement, which did not help us to understand the reality properly. I will exemplify it very shortly by comparing the FLN, the Algerian National Movement, and the ANC, the African National Congress. For many years, the Palestinian National Movement believed that it was modeled, or it modeled actually, or emulated the FLN as its major kind of national liberation organization. The biggest achievement of the FLN was kicking out 1 million French settlers back to France. That's how Algeria became fully independent. Not surprisingly, for very long, the Palestinian National Movement thought that this was the model. You have here colonizers who have to go back to their mother country. But settler colonialists don't have mother countries. Definitely don't have one mother country. They come from 100 mother countries in this particular case. So where do you kick them out to, right? The ANC was a different model. The ANC said, our decolonization of South Africa is not through sending back the Dutch, the British, the German, the Belgian, the Danish, who came and settled on our land, expropriated our land, expelled us, oppressed us. Our solution is not sending them back to their countries of origin. Our solution is to tell them, yes, you are organically now part of our homeland, but not on the basis of the political system that is called apartheid. And this is where Zionism and apartheid have something very much similar. You cannot have dreamt of changing the reality in South Africa. You cannot have even begun a genuine process of reconciliation in South Africa without getting rid of apartheid. You could not, and the ANC refused to say, let's negotiate and then we'll end apartheid. No, the ANC said apartheid will end and then we can start to talk about reconciliation, peace, justice, and democracy. Therefore, any peace paradigm that retains Israel as a Zionist state has no chance in the world of succeeding. In a similar way to the way that we have to get rid of apartheid, we have to get rid of Zionism before we talk about reconciliation. No other solution will work in this place. Because Zionism is a settler colonial movement, which is not a curse. I'm not cursing Zionism when I say it's a settler colonialist movement. America was built as a settler colonialist movement. Australia was built as a settler colonialist movement. Saying that the movement is a settler colonialist movement does not mean that I compare them to the Nazis or that I demonize them beyond any repair. No. Settler colonialism is a historical fact. People from Europe settled under the bayonet, with the help of the British bayonets, in someone else's land, took by force their land, expelled them, and continue to take by force their land, expel them, and not allow them equal rights as full citizens. It's actually a very simple story that Israel always tries to tell us is very complicated, and only they can understand how complicated it is, so you better follow their interpretation and ideas of solution. No, it's a simple story. Settler colonialism has affected the world in so many places that you don't need to invent the wheel to understand what goes on here in Palestine. It's not that unique, unfortunately, for white settlers to come colonize a place and call it their own homeland. It's also not quite unique, by the way, to create an apartheid system when genocide was not an option for whatever reason. Apartheid is the second best option, like ethnic cleansing, in order to implement the logic of elimination. I want to eliminate the native, but I cannot eliminate him or her physically. So I am enclaving him. I imprison the native in his own village. I don't allow him to expand in his cities. I put a siege on Gaza. I try to induce or convince the native to immigrate. There's so many things I can do as a powerful state that do not have to be translated into genocidal policies in order to feel that I completely fulfilled my idea of a successful settler colonial state. And hence, coming back to the Palestinian National Movement, the moment, and I think we are at this moment, that more and more Palestinian activists, politicians, intellectuals are beginning to accept the analysis of Zionism as settler colonialist movement, they also begin to accept the idea that the Jews who live here now for a third generation are part of the reality. We still need a very clear Palestinian message to the Jewish people who live here. How do you see us in the future? For too many years, the main thing the Palestinian National Movement did was to respond to Israelis' ideas of how Palestinians should live here. It's time to change the role. We need a clear Palestinian message to the people who are here. You are Jews who live in Palestine. This is how we see you in the future. We have never heard such a message. Not from a PLO leader, not from a PLO think tank, not from a Palestinian academic. It's time, now is the time to tell us and to make sure that you take back the initiative, because this is the native movement that will tell the settlers under what condition they can enjoy normal life after abusing the normal life of the native for more than a century. Let me just say a few things on the book, a few sentences, and then I'll move it. I don't want to anger him, because this is very shaky. And if he's angry, I will fall, because we are like on a boat here. So I don't want to get seasick. As some of you probably know, that one of the main focus of activity for Palestine in universities in the world is the Israel Apartheid Week. The Israel Apartheid Week is the main focus on 1 week of activity in solidarity with Palestine, initiated and conducted and organized by students. This brought the idea of the book in many ways, because it's very clear that for these students, the model of the struggle of solidarity with the ANC and against apartheid is the model that they're using for solidarity with Palestine. But we also felt, after looking at the activity, that apart from the very natural resemblance in the struggle for against apartheid in South Africa and against Zionism and the Israeli policies here in Palestine, apart from that, there is a need for a much more profound analysis of this comparison. So we took the idea of the activists and we said, let us go more deeply into the comparison, because obviously there must be also some dissimilarities, not only similarities. And now that so many of us are convinced that we have to struggle against Israel and its policies in the same way that the ANC struggled to end apartheid in South Africa, we should learn more properly as academics the differences and the commonalities between the two case studies. So we looked at every aspect we could, and we asked South African, Palestinian, Israelis, and a British journalist from Nazareth to join us in this project to try and look at different aspects. And I think what is so interesting in the book, that we have an insight into the history of apartheid in South Africa and the emergence of Zionism in Palestine, that shows that actually historically the similarities are very, very clear. And it's only when you move into the second half of the 20th century, especially after 1967, because of this very complex, and I know you'll talk about it, the complex issue of the difference between the way Israel controls the occupied territories and the way it controls Palestinian life inside Israel, this is something that did not fully exist in South Africa. And of course, a struggle in 1980 is not a struggle in 2016. And all these things are discussed in the book in a way that, of course, is only the beginning of a journey. It's not the end of the journey. Many more research has to be done on settler colonialism, anti-colonialism in Palestine. More research has to be done on comparing South Africa to Israel. But one thing we should not do, we should not regress back to the old conversation about this conflict as a conflict between two national movements, and one movement is democratic and the other one is less modern. One movement is Western, the other one is an Arab movement. We should not go back to this awful language that still is used by the main diplomacy and politics and academia and media in the West. We should insist on talking about Israeli apartheid, Israeli settler colonialism, Israeli ethnic cleansing, and we should not talk about peace and the end of occupation. We should talk about decolonization. We should all be part of an anti-colonialist movement that wants to decolonize this place for the sake of the native people and the settlers. And for that, we will also contribute something for the peace and stability in the region as a whole. Thank you.
I'd like to join Ilan in thanking the Educational Bookshop and the Institute for arranging tonight and hosting us here in this incredible garden. As Ilan said, I'm going to take the case study of the Palestinian minority inside Israel. Ilan very kindly invited me to contribute a chapter on that. I assume he drew the short straw for me. It's not so controversial anymore to suggest that there is an apartheid system or regime operating in the occupied territories. We have a US president, Jimmy Carter, who has said this. When you get to that point, you know you're on reasonably safe ground. But it's still controversial to suggest that Israel, inside its own internationally recognized borders, is operating some kind of apartheid system, discriminating against its Palestinian minority. And therefore, I want to address some of those issues, try and clarify some of these issues, as I did in the chapter, I hope. One point I want to make is that what we see in the apartheid in the occupied territories is something is apartheid, but as Ilan is saying, settler colonialism leads to apartheid-like systems, this elimination he's talking about. But it doesn't mean that this is all that we see in the occupied territories. I think we could talk about apartheid plus there. What I want to talk about is whether it's a fair analogy to talk about apartheid inside Israel, and I think it is. I actually think the apartheid comparison stands or falls not on whether there's apartheid in the occupied territories, but whether Israel is operating an apartheid system in its own territory against its Palestinian minority, 20% of the population inside Israel. We have a definition in international law, the UN's 1973 Convention on the Crime of Apartheid, and it refers to inhuman acts committed for the purpose of establishing and maintaining domination by one racial group of persons over any other racial group of persons and systematically oppressing them. In other words, to be an apartheid state or to have an apartheid system doesn't need to be exactly the same as apartheid in South Africa. Rather, there has to be some common or essential features. Israel, as Rand Greenstein has noted, is a cousin, not a twin, of apartheid South Africa. Now, my chapter in the book argues that we have systematic oppression by Israel's Jewish majority of the Palestinian minority in most spheres of life. I'll go through some of those areas, just to give you a sense of the scope. This isn't an exhaustive list by any means. We have two citizenship laws based on ethnic belonging, according each group different rights, especially in regards to immigration. We have national rights reserved for the Jewish but not for the Palestinian citizens of the state. And these national rights trump citizenship rights and institutionalized discrimination. We have no principle of equality enshrined in Israeli law, and that denies Palestinians the chance to legally challenge the system of discrimination they face. We have land laws that reserve sovereignty over almost all of the land, 93% of it, to a global, borderless Jewish nation rather than to Israeli citizens. We have segregation in residence and education that's designed to entrench ethnic identities, identity boundaries, and enforce systems of control. We have tight restrictions on the key resources of land and water, enforced through the kibbutz and the marshav and the associated admissions committees to prevent Palestinians from engaging in commercial agriculture. Instead, they're being consigned to the role of a dependent casual labor force in most cases. We have segregated tribal politics that make political participation for Palestinian citizens a charade, little more than window dressing, and that's been particularly underlined in the last week with this new expulsion law, which means that any Knesset member can be expelled from the parliament if a three-quarters majority take against their political views. We have law enforcement agencies that a judicial-led inquiry, the Orr Commission in 2004, concluded it treated the Palestinian minority as an enemy. We had vast swathes of the economy effectively off limits to Palestinians because national industries and the national infrastructure are defined as security sectors. We could go on and on with these, but you get the idea. So unlike South Africa, Israel has worked much harder to veil all of this institutionalized and systematic discrimination, humiliation, and oppression of its own citizens. The occupied territories, it's a different matter. The veiling there is they're not so concerned about veiling. But in Israel, the issue is about veiling this, concealing it. It's done this to conceal the visible aspects of apartheid. Now, my chapter, I suggest that instead, Israel has sought to create the illusion of visible equality as opposed to substantive or real equality. And I call that a confidence trick. And I think it rests on two pillars. These are arguments you will often hear Israel making when anybody raises this comparison that Israel is operating an apartheid system. The first one is that Israel's defenders will strenuously object if a comparison is made with apartheid South Africa, because they'll say that Israel does not prevent the country's Jewish and Palestinian citizens from mixing freely. Palestinian citizens, after all, can enter restaurants and cinemas in Jewish areas. This claim is less true than Israel supporters would like us to believe, but let us concede for the moment that it is true. How relevant is this in deciding whether Israel is an apartheid state? Scholars of apartheid South Africa drew a distinction between two aspects of the regime, what they called petty or trivial apartheid and what's known as grand or resource apartheid. For most of us, the essence of South African apartheid was separate park benches, separate restaurants, separate toilets, separate restaurants, separate buses, and so on. But that wasn't the situation with the scholars. They noted that the main goal of apartheid was to restrict the benefits of the state's key resources. In the case of South Africa, that was the land, water, and the mineral wealth, to the white minority. In short, visible segregation was a particular form South African apartheid took, but the content of the apartheid system, its strategic objective, was related to resources, not park benches. There's a reason why academics refer to the visible features of South African apartheid as petty or trivial. Now, Israel has reserved land and water as economic resources to be exploited by and for the Jewish population. As I mentioned earlier, 93% of the land is designated as belonging to a global Jewish nation, not the country's citizens. Water as a resource for use in agriculture is also reserved for Jews. Commercial agriculture and the cheap water it depends on are available only in Israel's hundreds of agricultural communities, the kibbutz and the moshav. There's also the so-called admissions committees that ensure only Jews can access these communities. Palestinians, therefore, through these admissions committees, are excluded both from the land and from the water. So why has Israel been able to mostly discard apartheid South Africa's petty or trivial features? In a black majority state like South Africa, enforced segregation was necessary because it created physical distance. It contributed to a sense of security. A small white minority craved as they ruled over a large black majority. Israel practices some visible segregation. There are separate living spaces, separate towns, villages and communities, and also separate education systems. But it can sell these limited forms of segregation as lifestyle choices or even as respect for communal and cultural autonomy. In Israel, segregation is not primarily needed, as it was in South Africa, to preserve physical distance and security. Here it serves a different role, to create a sense of emotional separation between the Jewish and Palestinian populations. By keeping members of the two populations apart during their formative years, during childhood, it is possible to maintain and entrench a tribal and antagonistic identity on both sides. Simply put, Israel does not want Jewish and Palestinian citizens to mix as children. Otherwise, they might create emotional bonds and connections that would undo the fear-inducing climate Israel has propagated. The second difference that typically is cited by Israel supporters is that blacks in South Africa were denied the vote, while Israel's Palestinian citizens have the same political rights as Jewish citizens. Again, this difference relates to the form of apartheid, Israel and South Africa's separate apartheid, not to the substance. The different electoral considerations reflect the different demographic circumstances the two states found themselves in. In South Africa, oppressed black population was a large majority. In Israel, the Palestinian population is a relatively small minority. South Africa could not afford to give the vote to the black population because it would have risked empowering them. Israel can give its Palestinian citizens a vote because absolutely no power accrues to them as a result. Those who oppose the apartheid comparison on these grounds are tricking us. They want us to overlook the historical context for Israel's generosity to its Palestinian citizens. The ethnic cleansing of 1948 that effectively gerrymandered Israel's political constituency. In short, we're expected to ignore the fact that through mass expulsions in 1948, Israel engineered a state that would largely be free of Palestinians. A Jewish majority was made to order. Let us conduct a quick thought experiment. Let us imagine that South Africa managed to forcibly expel 80% of its black population to the Bantustans, supposedly self-governing homelands. Let us imagine that it then forced the rump black minority, now living inside what had become a white majority area, into separate black-only communities, confined to a tiny proportion of the land and denied access to water and land and the state's key resources. Let us imagine, too, that the regime then allowed the black minority to vote in elections to a white-dominated parliament and allowed blacks to eat alongside whites in restaurants in white-majority areas. What would the international community have concluded about this situation? Would it have absolved South Africa of the crime of apartheid? Would it have claimed that there was no apartheid at all because white and black majorities ruled in their respective areas? Or would it have said that apartheid applied only in the Bantustans because in those locations the black population did not have the vote? Or, more plausibly, I would argue, would it have conceded that South Africa had simply engineered a more convoluted system of apartheid, and that the black minority living in white majority areas were still as much victims of apartheid as those in the Bantustans? In this thought experiment, analogous to the current situation in Israel, I think we would have little problem in understanding that the vote made little or no difference. The black population in white majority areas and in the Bantustans suffered under a single apartheid regime. This point is more important, I think, than it may at first seem. If we accept the argument that Israel is practicing an apartheid only in the Bantustans, or the occupied territories, then we give Israel license to claim that apartheid-like measures there may in fact be justifiable. By ignoring the unified nature of apartheid facing all Palestinians under Israeli rule, we give Israel the space to claim its policies in the occupied territories are driven by security considerations rather than the goal of systematic dispossession and resource theft. If there's no apartheid in Israel, then maybe Israel is right that the regime it has created in the occupied territories is a necessary response to security threats, rather than an integral part of an all-embracing apartheid system. I reject that idea. Rather, demonstrating that Israel is practicing apartheid inside its recognized borders is a vital step in confirming that it is also operating an apartheid regime, or worse, in the occupied territories. Okay.
You have been listening to historian Ilan Pappe and journalist Jonathan Cook speaking about their new book, Israel and South Africa, The Many Faces of Apartheid. And that is it for this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.